couple of notes about the stock market. In a moment, we'll visit with Philip Weiss, who has a few things to say about how the pandemic is rearing its ugly head in a way that he'll explain. But first, U.S. stocks wavered on Tuesday. That's today, as investors have analyzed the latest batch of first quarter earnings reports and enjoyed a recent decline in market turmoil. Things are relatively uneventful today, which is the new sigh of relief. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 79 points. This is moments old, or 0.2%. The S&P 500 added 0.4%. The NASDAQ advanced 0.5%. The three averages are coming off back-to-back winning sessions. Today's moves were in stark contrast to the volatile swings seen in recent sessions. The volatility index fell below 30 after hitting a high of around 60, remember, last week. And Tom Gimbel, the guy that we frequently visit with, I'll ask him to expand on this thought a little more the next time he joins us. But he did say, as a business reminder to all of us, be you a customer, an associate, a buyer, or a seller, say thank you. Not just for lunch or tickets to a ball game, say thank you for an introduction, for a job offer. The deal you said no to, the party invite where you met the connection of a lifetime. Say thank you for an opportunity. Say thank you for believing in me. Thank you for including me. Remember the friendship and referral tree. When you close a deal with a company or an individual, remember where that connection began and then say thank you. Your college friend introduced you to their friend. You met over drinks. You had lunch. They introduced you to their coworker, and so on and so on. That college friend started the ride for you, not knowing where it would go, not looking for anything in return. Trace back your deal flow when you get one. Trace back how you got this job or that project. Write a handwritten note and make a phone call. It means more than you realize. Any life is filled with ups and downs. By remembering where things originate, it helps bounce back from the valleys. Say thank you, says Tom Gimbel. What a warm, cheery thought. And yet, that's from Tom Gimbel. I'll have to talk to him about that and tease him about the good nature of that. But that's true, sir. Here's Philip Weiss. He is the president of Seyfarth at Work. Welcome back to the show, Philip.
Thanks for having me, John.
I didn't know what the answer was going to be. Is this deja vaccine for bosses, you post? And I didn't know what you were talking about. What are you talking about?
Yeah, well, this is an interesting revisitation, so to speak, of a challenge and question that bosses faced just a few years back in the midst of the COVID outbreak. And deja vaccine refers to how and when and if managers and bosses can require their employees to be vaccinated. In this case, it's not COVID. In 2025, it's all about measles. And of course, we're dealing with a very different animal, so to speak. You can't work really through measles. In some cases, you could work through COVID. So that's one interesting distinction. The other is that many people have already been vaccinated when it comes to measles. But given the severity of the outbreak, we're talking 24, 25 states, already as many deaths from measles as we saw in the last 24 years, bosses are worried. And so they're now opening their old playbook. They're revisiting what they did and did not do to encourage their own employees to get vaccinated when it came to COVID. And so that just fascinating for us to get questions that we had heard nothing about since about 2021, 2022.
Is this occurring in all states? I could see if I was in West Texas, but people in Illinois or California are concerned about this?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So to be very honest about this, we're getting many more questions from Southern Illinois, where we have some clients and contacts with manufacturing facilities, than we are around Chicago. But we've gotten the questions from various parts of the country. And bosses have said to us, look, we didn't expect this to be an issue, but we know we've got some employees who homeschooled their kids. Those kids may not have been vaccinated. That may make them and then their parents sick, and we have no idea who else in our workplace may not be protected. So I think there's a little bit of what you might call COVID shock that is sort of still emanating and reverberating through the workplaces. And the bosses are thinking, I just want to be one step ahead this time, given how deadly and debilitating measles can be.
Well, I wonder what we learned from COVID that we can apply then today.
Yeah, I mean, that is the $64,000 question, so to speak. And we learned a couple things that I believe managers are taking to heart, John. One is you can't expect or believe you can automatically mandate a vaccine, even when it comes to a deadly disease, in every case. Certainly healthcare settings, it's easier and more legally supported to do so. And therefore, information becomes critical. In some cases, you can incentivize people. Back in COVID, you may recall, there were contests and giveaways and cash bonuses. But here, you're talking about smaller pockets of employees who may not be vaccinated. And therefore, you got to think about the bigger body politic and making sure it's kind of a fair system. You don't want to be saying, okay, you weren't vaccinated, now you get some special additional advantage for doing what everyone else did when they were an infant. So interesting new realities, but a lot of longer-term lessons as well.
So I wonder what you do then. Like, I wonder if you said, okay, you can't work here until you can prove that you've been vaccinated. I don't know that that would work, and I don't know that that could work. And I see the disparity in giving a carrot to people that is, okay, we'll bonus you if you get vaccinated, because I was already vaccinated. Do I get a bonus? So what am I going to do, Philip?
Yeah, that is the debate that we're already hearing is taking place in executive boardrooms. And what I think people have landed on, John, is information is really your best friend. It's invaluable. And you mentioned Illinois versus, let's say, Texas. We've got some downstate clients who've had a lot of success inviting local doctors, people that were trusted in the community, to speak to their own employee base. That has actually moved the needle. And then ending that meeting by telling people, go talk to your own doctor. So if you're worried about the federal government and maybe its reliance on the latest science or lack thereof, then make it more local. Get a local authorities, work with local health professionals, yeah, and get the information out to your people.
You know, what you're reminding me of is early in the pandemic with COVID, people of color were reticent to do it, in part because they had been mistreated by the federal government and health authorities a generation ago. And these people remembered that or knew about that. And the way Northwestern, for instance, handled it was they got a doctor or doctors of color to go to the black churches in the city and talk to them as one of their own and remind them of the value of it. This sounds like a page from that book.
Yeah, that's a really valuable example. Because in an age of misinformation, of distrust, in fact, trusted messengers become the best allies for companies looking to protect their employees. It's a shame we need to think that strategically about who's talking to our people, but that becomes the reality and maybe the best tool in many cases.
It still sounds to me a little heavy-handed, I'll be honest with you, Philip. I mean, I'm Mr. Vax. I'm over-vaxxed. But three people have died because of measles. That may be the same number as the last 24 years, but it's still three people. I'm surprised that we're having this conversation.
Yeah, and this goes back to that first question you asked, John. I do think you may have a point there. We don't, you know, I don't want to be jumping the gun because measles is a deadly and debilitating disease, illness for many who contract it, especially at a young age. So we don't want to understate that reality. But at the same time, I do think there's this bit of almost like a PTSD, post-COVID shock syndrome, where bosses remembered the challenges of getting people vaccinated. They see the dangers that measles carries with it, and they just want to do right by their community. So the intentions are there. The intentions are good. It's about strategies to get the information out to people in a way that, as you say, is not heavy-handed, but is highly helpful.
Okay, but then is your advice to employers then, so make them aware of this and tell them the vaccine is available, maybe even make it available, but then you're not testing people, you're not documenting that, right? Or are you?
Well, that's an interesting point, because certainly if somebody contracts a disease and you're aware of it, you want to have a process so you can warn others who may have been in proximity of that person. If there's contact tracing, you want to work with a local health authority. So it's not to say that there's no record keeping here. It's got to be done by the right people in the organization. But for some employers, there are definitely are risks to ask too much, to delve into medical information. And the required vaccines are legally problematic in many cases as well. That's why we default to, as you said, making sure people know where to get the vaccines, making sure they have links to the local and maybe state health authorities that you trust. Right now, the CDC's website still talks about the incredible importance of vaccinations to prevent measles. So right now, the information is good at all three levels. It's companies' responsibility to get that information and those links and those resources to their employees.
One last question, Philip, and I'm surprised I don't, off the top of my head, know more about this, but can you legally require it, a COVID vaccine or a measles vaccine, for private sector employees?
Yeah, and there's a lot of litigation right now, still ongoing, John, in the wake of the COVID, the key COVID years, brought by employees who had a potentially legally to vaccinate, a religious objection, a disability, et cetera, like an allergy reaction, for example, risk. And those people were terminated for not being vaccinated. So the law is not entirely settled in terms of how far you can go. But I will say it is at a minimum risky to make a blanket requirement, a blanket mandate, particularly outside of healthcare settings where you know you are serving a vulnerable population such as patients. So it's different by industry. It's we're not in a place where we can say you can mandate it, because that's certainly not what the law is, but the law will probably be settled in a more clear way over the coming years.
Philip Weiss is the president of SciFarth at Work, SCYFARTH, SciFarth at Work. Nice to talk to you, Philip.
It's a pleasure, John. Thank you.
On Friday, we talked to a guy in Andersonville who runs a pen and paper shop. It's art supplies, it's stationery, it's those kind of products. It's a nice store. They've been in business for a couple of years. And while he's not a manufacturer, he is a retailer. And about half of his inventory comes from overseas. And enough of it comes from China. All of this is very complicated with the tariffs. It's hurting his business. And he's worried about how they're going to be able to survive. Here's an online retailer's story, somebody who not only sells goods, but also is the creator of, the manufacturer, if you will, of a product. Sari Wise joins us, the creator of Baby Paper. Babypaper.com is the website. And Sari, you're on WGN. How are you?
I've been better, but thank you for having me.
Yeah, I understand that. Where are you located? Where's your business? Where do you operate from?
We are outside of Chicago. We do all of our distribution from a warehouse in Mundelein, and our sourcing agent is based in Pennsylvania.
And what do you make?
I make sensory toys for babies and beyond, and we manufacture 100% in China.
What are some examples of the things you make?
So our signature product is our baby paper. It's just a safe, simple, effective sensory toy for babies and beyond. Adults love our products too. We also have a line of plush, and everything we have crunches. So it's very satisfying. It's great for babies, traveling with baby, sitting in a restaurant, which is actually how I created it. It's wonderful if you have a baby who's going through some medical procedures.
How so?
Because it helps. There's something that just helps to keep the babies calm.
Yeah.
It just, you know, they love it. They can crunch it from the time they can start grasping. They're mesmerized by it.
Well, you know, so there's a 1-year-old in my life right now, and And you know how it is when you give a kid a gift and they're more interested in the wrapping paper than the gift? It's it's classic. We have some of your product now that I was watching it online as well. And Jane will take it and she will crinkle it. She seems to like the sound and the texture. You make that stuff, right?
I do.
What a good idea.
I came up with the idea when I used to hand my kids napkins in restaurants.
Yeah, right. So your product is made in China. How long have you been in business?
I came up with the idea probably about 18 years ago, but really focused on it. It's going on 11, 12 years now.
How big is the business? How many people do you employ, or how much product do you sell?
So we're in approximately 700 specialty retailers throughout the U.S. and Canada. That's our main forte. We do sell online. We sell on Amazon and Walmart, Bye Bye Baby. Our main focus, though, is Main Street USA.
Yeah. And you're a small business. Are you a million-dollar operation?
No, we're under $1 million. Our products sell, our signature product sells for around $7.
So what have the tariffs meant to you?
What the tariffs have meant to me is that I have about enough product to last me a couple months. And that said, I'm out of stock on some of our better sellers. I can't bring them in. You know, at 145%, it's cost prohibitive. When they first announced the 10%, that was tough. 20% was, you kind of gasp, but okay, we can figure this out. But beyond that, we just can't bring it in.
This is There's product a point. That you've had manufactured at your factory that makes it for you in China, and it sounds like sitting there, and you're ready to capture it, pay for it, but with the tariffs, you don't want them to ship it because you can't afford it if it comes in. Is that right?
That's exactly it. We've directed the factory to stop production. Like I said, I use a sourcing agent out of Pennsylvania, and she just had to let 20% of her workforce go.
What is the cost to manufacture one of your goods versus the price I'll pay in the store?
We work really close. Our margins are tight because we're a small manufacturer, and we have to be able to compete with the larger guys. So, Keystone pricing is generally, if it costs the store $3, they're going to sell it for $6. So we work on a tight margin, maybe 40% underneath that.
I ask that because I think if we say, okay, there's a $6 item, what's a 145% tariff? That doesn't get it to $15. It's 145% of the manufactured cost. But then if you add in taxes and shipping and tariffs, it's more, but it's not 1.5 or 2.5 times that amount. So I wonder if you absorb fully the tariff, what would the cost on the shelf be? How much more expensive would it be online or at the store?
It would have to be double.
It would.
Yeah, it would still have to be double because, like you said, you still have the freight cost. You still have, packing costs, and you still have, it doesn't come in and then there's no expenses going out.
But those costs don't go up 145%. Shipping is still shipping.
No. So, and 145%, even if you use the Keystone pricing from the, that a retailer might use, you're talking about that it would still go up probably about 50%.
50% more.
So, yeah.
And this
so
is
our $7 product would end up being $10 or $11.
And you don't think you can make it on, the people won't pay that for it?
I don't think so. And plus, it's such a risk. So let's say I do agree to paying the 145% tariffs, which it's a lot of money for a small business to have to cough up. What if those tariffs get rolled back after I've paid it?
Right. I understand the conundrum that represents. And underlying all of this, and we haven't said it, is we were told that we wouldn't pay for this, the manufacturer would, or China would. Is there any communication down the line to you that they don't want to lose you and me, you as a retailer, me or as a manufacturer, me as a customer? They don't want to lose. We're in the driver's seat. We're the ones that are going to give them the money. Is there any indication that they will be willing to cut their costs on their end?
Yeah, so when the first round of tariffs were announced, we negotiated with the factory, or at least my sourcing agent did. And we were able to say, okay, we can handle this. We can absorb this. But what I'm hearing from a lot of manufacturers is that they are actually looking for businesses in Europe and other countries who are going to take their goods in. So they're still producing the goods, but they're not coming to the U.S.
Have you been able to find somebody in the U.S. that would make this for you? Can we make this here in Chicago?
I have tried for 10 years, and I've gotten samples from some manufacturers. They can't really scale it. They can't get to the volume I need. The cost was double, and the quality was way lower. And I actually had a lot of them say this isn't worth it for us to make.
Sure. We're talking with Sari Weitz, and her business is Baby Paper, babypaper.com. You can see the products online. It's a Chicago area firm, and they make these crinkly paper toys, if you will, for kids. It sure does pacify them, and anybody with a little kid knows what a good product that is. And about the inability to make it to the United States, is it because simply the machines would cost more and the labor would cost more, that it's so much less expensive on that end in China that there's just no way you can make it at a price point that makes it viable here? Is that your experience?
Yes, we don't have the infrastructure here. And particularly, most of my products are soft goods, but particularly, you know, in the toy industry, a lot of it is plastic, metal. And those are the machines that China already has in place that we don't have here.
One last thing. You said you have inventory. We have to end this conversation now. And I know that you've participated in-person and Zoom chats about small businesses. You're an advocate for small business. But what's going to happen to your small business when you run out of your inventory in the storerooms?
I'm going to have to shut down. And the impact of that is that my sourcing agent loses money, my sales reps lose money, retailers don't have product to put on their shelves. I have a fulfillment center that's going to lose my business. Now multiply me times thousands and thousands of people who are just like me, and that's a huge impact on America and on American jobs and on our economy.
Sari Weitz is the creator of Baby Paper. Babypaper.com is the website. Sari, why don't you stay in touch? Let us know as we all follow this story as it evolves. Let us know how things go. I appreciate your time today.
I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
More business news on the Wintrust Business Lunch. This is Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. A Chicago trading firm says it's being acquired by a New York-based company. R.J. O'Brien & Associates is being bought for $900 million in cash and stock by StoneX Group. The deal is expected to close later this year, pending regulatory review. As part of the purchase, StoneX will absorb O'Brien's 75,000 client accounts. O'Brien, also known as RJO, is one of the oldest independent futures brokerage firms in the country and is one of the founding members of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. RJO has 300 employees in Chicago. StoneX says the newly combined company will continue to have a presence in Chicago. The University of Chicago Booth School of Business has received a $100 million donation from private equity investor Konstantin Sokolov. According to Cranes, the donation is earmarked for the school's executive MBA program. Sokolov graduated from the school 20 years ago. According to the university, the gift will fund the program's scholarships and operations. The executive MBA curriculum will be renamed after him. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
We have this Business of Food report with Steve Alexander.
Yeah, thank you. And despite the recent rain, the D word is still in our weather vocabulary. We had a very dry winter across much of the Midwest, and it may be getting drier. Some meteorologists are predicting a 60% chance of drought across the corn and soybean belts this summer.
One thing I might argue at this point is that a pretty good chunk of the Midwest is already experiencing some degree of drought.
Who he is, why he's saying that after I thank the Chevy Silverado for sponsoring us today. There has never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. Find out how at ChevyDrivesChicago.com. Brad Rippey is on the phone. I like to call him the talented Mr. Rippey. What about the predictions by some of your colleagues that we are headed for a drought this summer across the Midwest?
Yeah, so you have to trace this all the way back to last fall. We had that very dry late summer autumn period. We did get a little bit of moisture later in the autumn, but then think about the snow season. Places like Chicago are still looking at accumulation season to date for snowfall less than one half of normal. That's a pretty broad scale thing going on across the upper Midwest on into the Great Lakes region. So expectations, at least for parts of the Midwest, for a drier than normal growing season. And that sounds like drought to me, unfortunately.
Am I wrong in thinking, Brad, that our weather used to not be so volatile and the new norm seems to be more severe swings in temperature and moisture?
Yeah, I feel like it is. You really got to go back quite a ways, almost a decade, to find a year that we didn't have significant effects from either heat or drought or both. And I would argue you go back to 2009 to actually find the last almost perfect growing seasons.
Okay, well, a dry summer, maybe drought is a possibility, but keep in mind, it is a forecast.
I hope I'm wrong, and I hope we have a wonderful, productive, and record-setting growing season.
The talented Mr. Rippey, USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey. On the food calendar, just ahead of Easter, it's National Glazed Spiral Cut Ham Day. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
The Roanoke Hospitality Group, here's a headline, is expanding its portfolio. So let's talk just briefly a little bit about this business that you may actually be eating in or doing business with in the Loop. Brian Garish is here, the founder and CEO of the Roanoke Hospitality Group. Hi, Brian. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for inviting me in.
Your places are what and where? Where do I find you?
Well, predominantly the Loop. We started about 8 years ago, 9 years ago, with a restaurant called Roanoke. It's in the building where the Marriott's Residence Inn is, and it's a historic building that goes back into the 1920s that was called the Roanoke Building. It was originally the Lumber Exchange here in the Loop, in the financial district in the heart of the Loop. And as we got into the pandemic and post-pandemic, and we had the opportunity, as a lot of restaurateurs were just uncertain of the future of the financial district in the Loop, had left, and we were approached by several different landlords and hotels to come in and to revitalize their restaurants. So we currently operate 7 different restaurants, primarily here in the Loop. The Roanoke, which was our first restaurant, which became a great lunch hotspot even pre-pandemic. Then we opened up in the LaSalle Hotel, right here also on LaSalle, the Grill on 21. We have a French restaurant over in the Hyatt Center called Bandol. And we're about to open a new restaurant in the Kimpton Hotel, which will be called La Bella, which will be an Italian trattoria.
So is that a gamble right now? I guess maybe the pandemic is sufficiently in the rearview mirror, and leaving aside tariffs, because I don't know exactly how that would impact you all, but how safe a business, how good is the business if you are operating restaurants in these, you know, landmark buildings downtown?
Well, we certainly feel that we're early in on the transition of the neighborhood, but I was just reading today in Cranes, they were still talking about some of the occupancy and things like that are going on.
Right.
But it's also in the news that there's very exciting things coming here where, you know, number one, the buildings that are here are just, they're Chicago landmarks, and they're not going anywhere. They're beautiful, beautiful buildings, but they are going through a transition of a multi-use. Some of them are getting converted into condos, apartments. There's quite a few hotels that are here.
Is that good for your restaurants? I wonder if it's more residential, maybe you have a more permanent customer base there.
Yeah, you know, for sure we still do continue to do well weekdays lunch. The downtown working workforce is not what it was 10, 15 years ago, but that we do feel the transition is evening out the business trends throughout the week. So we're very positive about seeing the residential coming in, and there's been a lot of things done with the city, small business loans to revitalize, in particular, the LaSalle corridor. They have reimagined LaSalle, where there's small business loans available to retailers to really get in and help them get through this period and get into the transition. With Google coming into the neighborhood, we're very excited about seeing new workforces coming in. And we think that'll be, it'll continue to see the trend of, you know, in 10 years or so, 5-10 years, we're going to see this being a very, very vibrant area, not unlike some of the areas that were over in the West Loop where they were 10 years ago or so. So we're very excited and very bullish on continuing our development here.
As a guy who spends a lot of time downtown, I'd love to see the LaSalle corridor flourish like the West part of the loop that you just described. And we need good restaurants to make that happen. Brian Garish is the founder and CEO at Roanoke Hospitality Group, and they got a bunch of places that he referred to, Grill on 21, the 101 Rooftop, the 101 Bar and Grill. Very nice. We love those rooftops when the weather gets warmer. Brian, good luck to you this fall, spring, summer, winter, whatever. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks. Check us out on roanokehospitality.com, and you can see all the restaurants and some of the things we got going on. Thank you for your time.